Good evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts, arts and entertainment in our region as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. Tonight we'll hear from Bruce Belland of the Four Preps. The Token's Mitch Margo passed away very recently, and the Four Preps will be performing in their stead alongside the Marcells, the Chantels, the Mystics, Lala Brooks of the Crystals, and the Skyliners. That's Legends of Doo-Wop and Rock and Roll at the California Theater in San Bernardino, December 16th. AffordableMusicProductions.com for information and tickets. We're going to start tonight with comedy, Indigenous stand-up comedy, coming to FNX TV soon, and San Bernardino even sooner.
Please welcome your host and MC for the evening, Graham Elmwood.
That's what I'm talking about. It's Graham Elmwood. He added an M because that's how exciting tonight's going to be, you guys. It's cool. We've got the big fancy cameras here to make it all look show businessy. So that mispronunciation of my name was in 4K.
I'm just hoping to do commercials, if anything. That'd be fine. It'd be like a shampoo commercial. You never see Indians doing that, right? If you have a dry, flaky scalp, just throw it away.
You're listening to KVC Arts. I'm Rick Dulock. My guest is Graham Elmwood. He is director, producer, and MC of a new program that's going to be on the FNX channel called Custer's Last Stand-Up. Welcome, Graham. Thanks for being with me today.
Rick, thanks for having me on. I'm really excited about this.
The interesting thing about this show that's going to be on the FNX channel is that we're going to record the shows right here in the Inland Empire on the campus of San Bernardino Valley College. So we'll talk more about that later, but let's first find out a little bit about you, Graham Elmwood. How did you become director, producer, and MC of a new comedy show?
Well, at a very young age, I realized I didn't ever want to have a real job. So I just decided to get into show business, and basically it's joining the circus. So I started doing stand-up comedy when I was a freshman at the University of Arizona. The MC of this college comedy competition that I joined was a young man by the name of Judd Apatow. And
oh, wow.
He was wearing acid-wash jeans and a mullet. This was a while ago. it's on my YouTube channel. And then I joined a comedy group called Comedy Corner. And in that group, I met Micah Wright. He and I have been friends ever since. I was a film major there, and I also started working as a professional stand-up comic, and that's what I've been doing since I graduated a million years ago. And in the spring, Micah became the head of programming at FNX and was like, hey, Graham, I'm trying to bring a bunch of new programming and new shows to the network. What do you got? And I said, how about, you know, a Native American-themed stand-up comedy show where we have comics that are not just Native but world indigenous people and big-name acts coming in? And he's like, that's great. And he knew I had a lot of experience doing, you know, independent stuff. I've done two feature documentary films. I'm also the co-producer of the Los Angeles Podcast Festival. So I just came with a lot of experience in putting something together with a handful of nickels.
Right. Well, so you guys had the original idea, and then you probably started, you know, mulling it around and figuring it out. So this first show is coming up on Sunday, December 17th. It will be at 7 p.m. at San Bernardino Valley College in the auditorium. It's a beautiful theater space with about 500 seats in San Bernardino. Incidentally, ticket information is available online at fnx.org/comedy. So the first show, do you know what's going to happen in the first show? Do you have your comedians?
Yeah, we've got an amazing lineup. We've got Mark Yaffe and Jim Rule. They've been comics for a long time. They're pros. I worked with Jim Rule years ago at the Comedy Cafe in Milwaukee. And then we also have Sheila Chalicki that Jim recommended to me. She's very funny. And Leah Mansfield. I saw Leah at Flapper's Comedy Club back in October. So it's really four comics each doing about 15 minutes each. It's going to be really amazing. And I love the theater space there. We were looking for venues. We were thinking about doing some of these comedy clubs in Hollywood and all this. And then Micah goes, hey, man, there's this theater that was like built in the 20s that's just beautiful here on the campus. And we all walked in and we're like, well, this is awesome. This is where you want to do a comedy TV show.
Yeah, it's a really nice space.
It's just gorgeous. And, you know, FNX, all of their camera gear and everything is right there on the campus. So we're super excited about bringing Native comics that maybe you haven't heard of and also just very funny people it's really exciting. No one's ever done anything like this. There's been little one-off shows of Native-themed comics and stuff, but no one's ever done a full 13 episodes, and this first episode that we're shooting December 17th. So anybody listening, you're coming out, you're helping support comedians and Native American comedians and a new show, and you're going to be really a part of this amazing comedy and artistic community on the campus and FNX.
Very nice, and it's going to be 13 episodes. So the first one will be on Sunday, December 17th. And then that will premiere sometime in February on the FNX channel. So you're going to do 12 more, but I understand there's going to be a little break in there or something. Can you run us down the dates?
So, yeah, we shoot this first one December 17th, and then we're off for about a month. Part of that is for the holidays, but also we want to kind of take a month to get the show edited and also see what we want to do, any little minor changes or whatever. And then we start up January 14th. January 21st, January 28th. They're all on Sundays at 7 p.m. The first weekend in February is Super Bowl Sunday, so we'll take that off, and then we start up again February 11th, February 18th, February 25th, and then March 4th, 11th, and 18th. And we're getting a lot of big-name comedians to come in, like Nick Schwartzen is committed, Craig Shoemaker's committed, Nikki Glaser's coming out. I've been doing stand-up a long time, and I know a lot of these big-name headliners, and they're really excited about coming out. Plus, we've got Larry Omaha, Will Spotted Bear, Jackson Purdue, Chris Fairbanks, Laura House. I mean, just packing in an amazing lineup of comics that you have probably seen on TV, and if you haven't, you're going to be seeing a lot of professionals and, like, up-and-coming comics getting a really big break. So it's really exciting what Micah and I have been talking about doing. The fact that it's actually becoming a reality is something we're really excited about.
Well, you know, the neat thing that I see about stand-up comedy is, you know, you get a couple of names there to get people there, and then you get a couple of people there that want to be a big name someday. And it all mixes together to just be something that is a funny experience. You meet some new comics, and you see some of your favorite comics. It's just a great thing. I'm really looking forward to this 13-part series called Custer's Last Stand-Up. Who came up with the name?
It was actually Micah. Micah is part Native, and he came up with that title. And I remember laughing, but I said, "Like, can we? Are you sure? Will this bother anybody?" And he goes, "Graham, it was Native Americans' greatest military victory against General Custer, who wasn't a really nice guy to the Natives." So he goes, "I love the title." And every Native person I've told to starts laughing because they see the significance of the history of Native American victory over General Custer. So I thought it was a great title, and I thought it was really funny, and it was his idea. I was like, I don't know. He was like, "Nah, man, I want to do this. I want to do this." So
yeah,
so
and Mike,
I want to make this point.
Right. Micah Wright is the director of FNX, and he runs the station and is a very creative person, and I've had some interactions with him, and he's really fun to work with. He always has interesting ideas, to be sure.
Yeah. And I think, too, part of it was Mike and I both talked about, like, I want this to be a type of show where comics can, like, maybe do more material that's political or social commentary. And that was part of the reason of the title, was like bringing light to the history of that was, and letting the audience and comics know. Because a lot of times on the TV shows, it's like, oh, you can't talk politics. You can't talk too social commentary. It's got to be really sort of watered down. And we were like, nah, we want comedians to, like, you know, have an artistic voice about society and culture and history. And I want that sort of environment.
Yep.
I grew up watching Bill Hicks and Lenny Bruce and Richard Pryor and Chris Rock. And now Tig Notaro, Maria Bamford, Sarah Silverman, these are friends of mine, and they do a lot of political and social commentary. And they're very funny doing it, and that to me is the art form and the beauty of the art form of stand-up comedy. And I know a lot of Native American comics that have a lot of material about being Native and how Natives have been treated, and the fact that they can cover that in a comedic way, I love it. It's like, if you can get a laugh and make a point, man, I want that. I want that in the show, and I want the audience to get that and know that that's what they're coming out for.
Yeah, that's a win-win. So it's Custer's Last Stand-Up. The first iteration will be on Sunday, December 17th at 7 p.m. So listeners, you're invited to come to the show. Ticket information is available online at fnx.org/comedy. These will take place at San Bernardino Valley College in the beautiful auditorium. It's a beautiful theater space, about 500 seats, so there's plenty of space. Bring all your friends. It's going to be very affordable. I think tickets start at $15, and then they're below that if you're a student. So it's very affordable. It's going to be fun. December 17th is the first one, and then January 14th, 21st, and 28th. February 11th, 18th, and 25th. March 4th, 11th, and 18th. We're shooting a whole season of Custer's Last Stand-Up starting on Sunday, December 17th.
It's going to be a great night. It's going to be an amazing night of comedy. You're going to see some amazing comics that you've probably never seen before. And as you said, tickets are $15. They're $10 with a student ID. So come out. You're going to get a lot for your money. You're supporting a new thing. Get involved on the ground floor to be like a part of this community and a part of this show and this network.
And if you are familiar with Native Comics, Mark Yaffe, Jim Rule, Sheila Chalicki, and Leah Mansfield will be there. Is that right?
That's correct.
Perfect. All right. Ticket information again at fnx.org/comedy. Graham Elwood, thank you very much for being on KBC Arts today.
Rick, thanks for having me, man. Really appreciate it.
First time I went to the Navajo Reservation, deer in the headlights. The Navajos are very traditional people, my tribe out there, and they want to know two things on the Navajo Reservation. They want to know your chapter house and your clan. Mark, do you know your chapter house? I'm like, chapter 11. I don't know. Do you know your clan? I'm like, Wu-Tang. I don't know.
The FNX channel was created through a partnership between the San Bernardino Community College District, KVCR Television, and the San Manuel Band of Mission Indians. FNX has 20 affiliates in 16 states. Most are PBS stations like KVCR TV. Others are over-the-air and cable channels available on and around Native American reservations. Potential audience nationwide of FNX, 46 million viewers. I'm Rick Dulock. You're listening to KVC Arts.
Thank you, Rick. When KVC Arts continues, we'll have music from the Four Preps and conversation with one of the original members, Bruce Belland. The Four Preps are part of a six-act lineup coming to the California Theater in San Bernardino soon. More on that just ahead as well. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. Online at kvcrnews.org, I'm David Fleming. The Marcells, the Chantels, the Mystics, Lala Brooks of the Crystals, the Skyliners, and the Four Preps will be at the California Theater in San Bernardino December 16th as Legends of Doo-Wop and Rock and Roll. AffordableMusicProductions.com for tickets and information. The Four Preps are slated to perform in the place of the Tokens, who just the day after Thanksgiving lost their leader, Mitch Margo. And being such a last-minute add to the lineup, the first thing I did was to thank Bruce for stepping in so quickly.
Thank you. Well, I'm delighted to do it. The Gothels are good buddies of mine, and we've worked for them a lot in the past. And anytime we can get up and sing some doo-wop, have some fun, I'm all for it.
Oh, that's what we love to hear. That is fantastic. Well, I want to, of course, go to the earliest of days with a group. It starts before you were even out of high school. Let's approach it this way. Folks, generally speaking, in a high school talent show, usually don't have record execs out in the audience.
You know, it's funny. I hate to dispel that legend, which has gone around and around. It's not actually true. First of all, there are some. In fact, I just have my webmaster is rewriting the Wikipedia entry because half of it is incorrect. But we did not get discovered at that talent show. We did the talent show for the student body, you know, and there was no talent scout out in the audience, although I suppose that may be a more romantic way to put it.
Sure.
It was about a year later we did a dance at UCLA for a sorority, and somebody in our band made a copy of the live show we did out there, and that was what got taken to Capitol Records by the man who became our manager, and that prompted them to pick the phone up and call him and say, yeah, we'd like to sign the guys. So that's how that happened.
Oh.
But the talent show was where it all first began.
Now by yourself. Shaboom,
shaboom. Oh,
shaboom, shaboom.
Oh, yeah.
Shaboom, shaboom.
Shaboom. The Temecula Tabernacle Choir.
We sang Shaboom, speaking of doo-wop. And, you know, that was the beginning of it all.
That is a great classic doo-wop tune that you're not the first person that has spoken to me about covering.
Oh, yeah, and how can you miss the lyric like, hey, donny, ding, dong, a-lang-a-lang-a-lang, boom-ba-do, ba-do, ba-do. I mean, that's a heck of a lyric. You know?
Oh, yeah, it must have taken minutes.
It's credited, and I think it's probably accurate. It's credited with being the first sort of R&B doo-wop song to go to number one on the pop charts. Yeah, we'll definitely be doing that. I mean, you know, we've got 50 songs we could pick from, but I'm going through it and cherry-picking all the really, you know, get-down, hardcore doo-wop stuff, so we'll have some fun with it.
Life could be a dream if I could take you up to paradise up above. If you would tell me I'm the only one that you love. Life could be a dream, sweetheart. You, you, shaboom, shaboom. You, you.
You guys did chart pretty early in your career with Dreamy Eyes. Were you still in high school then when Dreamy Eyes came out?
Two of the guys were. I was out. I graduated in 55 and we recorded Dreamy Eyes in 56. Funny story about that song, if you got a minute, I'll
yes,
tell
please.
You.
Yes, please.
We were performing all over town trying like crazy to get a recording contract, and this is before Capitol signed us, and we were doing proms and bar mitzvahs and barbecues and anything we could sing at. And we were doing a prom for our Santa Monica High School out at the Miramar Hotel in Santa Monica. And we got a note from a gentleman that said, I'm a songwriter. I'm looking for somebody to make demos of my songs. I would like to talk to you about possibly recording. We did the show and went out and met him in the lobby afterwards, and he took us to the coffee shop for a little bite and some conversation, and he said, I'll pay you $25 a song. I've got two songs I'd like you to make demos of. We worked with him for, oh boy, about a solid month. Every day he wanted every conceivable doo-wop affectation possible put in that. And the deal he made with us, he said, when I take Dreamy Eyes around to the record companies, you know, I'll also mention that the group that made the demo is available for a recording contract if you're interested. So we said, hey, that's great. We made Dreamy Eyes at Gold Star Recording Studio, the legendary one on Santa Monica and Vine Street. The songwriter, Jack Hoffman, took it around for about 6 months and then called me very down and sad about the whole thing. He said, boy, I've been all over town. I got a few people semi-interested in the song, but I can't get anybody interested in you guys, and I'm so sorry. Have a nice life. A couple months later, we get signed by Capitol. We go into Capitol for our first meeting and meet our producer, Voyle Gilmore, you know, who produced people like Frank Sinatra and Keely Smith and, you know, all the biggies.
Sure.
And he came walking in for the first meeting in the conference room with a stack of records about a foot high. And we knew these were the rejects everybody else had turned down because
yeah.
We were mad on the totem pole. And about the fourth record, and he picked it up, he said, now this one, he said, I don't think you guys can probably get as authentic a doo-wop, you know, street corner sound is this group that made the demo, but if you can get anywhere close to this, maybe we should think about it. Well, he put it on, and it was our demo of Dreamy Eyes. So we started to laugh, and then he started to play. He said, wait a minute, it's not that bad a song. We said, no, that's not why we're laughing. That's us. He said, you can sing that way? We said, yeah. He said, oh, my gosh. Well, so that became our first record, and it charted for a week or two, and then disappeared, and after that we had six or seven or eight single releases of big fancy orchestrations with people like Nelson Riddle and all kinds of arrangers, and you know, nothing happened, and then along came the little song about the island and everything changed. But
that's
kind of a funny story about Dreamy Eyes. He played a demo for us and said, if you can sound anything like these guys, you know, and there we were.
Oh my gosh, that is so funny. As you mentioned, you had several things, Moonstruck in Madrid and Falling Star and, gosh, Band of Angels. Now, here's one that I kind of have to ask about. On Falling Star, just for example, I really loved the B-side, Where Was You? Now, Falling Star, no kidding. Falling Star was
David,
so gentle.
I'm seriously wondering about your taste level here. Where Was You? That was the first song Gwen and I wrote together. I play it sometimes, and it just is you realize how totally different our career would have been and our image would have been if that was a hit.
You've been in the Coasters again.
Yeah, yeah. It's like a hard kick rock and roll with the raunchy saxophone solo in the middle. Yeah, I don't know. I wrote that in about 15 minutes and Glenn added a couple of lines to it and we recorded it. Well, a lot of people want to know about Falling Star and why it wasn't a bigger hit because I thought it was a nice song, but I've never heard anybody before mentioned Where Was You. Thank you, David. I'm very flattered.
Oh, you got it, man. You know, Falling Star for me, that was another pretty song. It was beautiful,
yeah,
okay?
Yeah, that's true.
But
it was
the
a little
other
innocuous,
one,
I guess, and didn't sell much, so that proves in the pudding.
Yeah, Where Was You on the other? You're snapping your fingers, tapping your foot before you even know what's going on, and then, as you said, the raunchy sax, that's it, yeah.
That's funny. I love it. Well, what can I tell you? That's quite a legacy to leave that song by.
Yeah. May have just come to the forefront again. Can you think of maybe another B-side that, say, maybe you thought the B-side should have been the one that you were releasing, but Capitol was saying, no, let's do it this way instead? Can you think of another
one,
Bose?
I always liked Moonstruck in Madrid. I always thought it was a really cute song. And, you know, we were very much a transitional group when you think about it, because there's Moonstruck in Madrid with a big string section, full orchestra, and on the other side, a song that I thought was going to be a hit called I Cried a Million Tears.
Yeah.
Our adoration and admiration for the Four Aces and the Four Lads could certainly be heard on those sides. We really idolized those groups and tried as best we could to sound like them with that super emotional kind of delivery. But yeah, that would be a B-side. I guess Moonstruck, I don't know what the A-side was, if it was Moonstruck Madrid or I Cried a Million Tears, but either one of them I thought had a chance. It's just strange. I mean, we kept making these records and the disc jockeys kept playing them and nobody was buying them. But I started to wonder if maybe there wasn't some way we, within the group, could write a song. But our producer, wonderful guy, who I really admired, was so good to us over the years at Capitol. Mm-hmm. And he took me aside one day very patiently when I said, would you listen to some songs we've written? And he said, let me explain something to you. Eddie Fisher, Patti Page, they don't write songs. Songwriters write songs, and then they sing them. You're a singer. We'll find a hit for you. Don't worry about it. But to show you the transitional nature of our group,
yes,
26 Miles, David, has a five-man, really, country band. Joe Maphis was the lead guitar player, who's a country guitar player. Five people on the front side with a 22-piece swing band orchestrated by Billy May. On the self-same record, 22-piece big kind of swing, bop, ba do 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 do, and on the other side of it is 26 Miles with five pieces. Thank goodness some guy in Hartford, Connecticut, a late-night disc jockey, turned the record over one night because everyone was instructed by Capitol to play the A-side, which was a song called It's You from The Music Man, which is such a lame song, it finally got taken out of the final show. But and they had invested money in The Music Man, and they wanted to release some singles on the score before the show opened on Broadway, so we got stuck with a song called It's You.
Yeah.
It was great recording with Billy May. That was fun, and that was very exciting, but on the back, as kind of a favor to us, that kind of threw us a crumb, they put our little song of 26 Miles. Well, lo and behold, one night, a disc jockey in Hartford, Connecticut, late night, wants to take a bathroom break. So after he plays It's You, which is what Capitol told him to play, he turned it over and played 26 Miles. And when he came back, the phone was lighting up like crazy. He got about 40 phone calls wanting to know about that little song he just played.
Miles across the sea, Santa Catalina is awaiting for me. Santa Catalina, the island of romance, 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 romance.
I started to write it in junior high on the beach. And then when we went record after record without a hit, Glenn said, what about that little Catalina song you used to sing? I had written four or five verses by then, and he and I sat down and added a bridge and a couple of new verses, 40 kilometers in a leaky old boat and all that stuff. You know, the funny thing about it was when we wrote it, neither of us had ever been to Catalina. Well, the reason I knew all about Catalina and how romantic and picturesque it was is that the first 10 years of my life, before my family moved to West Hollywood, I grew up in Chicago. Well, no kid on the northwest side of Chicago where I grew up is anything but a diehard Chicago Cubs fan.
Yeah.
Well, The Chicago Cubs are owned by William Wrigley. William Wrigley also owned a little island called Catalina. So what he would do in the spring for spring training, start of the baseball season, is send the Cubs to Catalina. So I'm a little 10-year-old kid in the newsreel in Chicago when I'm freezing my fanny off outside the theater, and I'm watching these guys in short sleeve shirts with palm trees in the background and the sun shining. And I'm thinking, wherever this Catalina is, I got to get there. This looks like a great place. So that's how I knew about the island and what it looked like when I wrote the song.
You hadn't even heard of the Avalon Ballroom. It was all because of the Cubs.
That's exactly right. I hadn't heard of it.
Way to go, Bruce.
We were surfing on the beach one day. In fact, we cut school. I was taking geometry in summer school, and I came up to Sunset to hitchhike east into Hollywood to go to summer school, and there were four or five of my buddies on the other side of Sunset hitchhiking to go west to the beach. So I ran back down and got my ukulele and my towel, and we didn't surf with surfboards in those days. We body surfed. So surfed for 3 or 4 hours, and then we're laying around in the sand just kicking back, and somebody said, "Wow, look, you can see Catalina." Somebody else said, "How far is it?" Somebody said, 25, 26 miles. So I picked up my ukulele, 26 miles, and that was how it started. And I put it in a drawer for a year or two, and after we were with Capitol for almost a year and had a hit, thank goodness, Glenn remembered the song and said, "Let's take it out and look at it, and maybe we can do something with that." Well, once we got it written, then we had to convince Will Gilmore to let us record it. And the deal we made with him was we were going to go in and record It's You, the Music Man song, which was their big plug side.
Sure.
And if we had enough time left on the session, he would let us record our little song. So we got It's You done in about 3 takes. We learned it and had it down cold. We wanted to get it done and get to our song. So then we finished It's You. Billy Mason and his 22-piece band home. They all packed up and left. And we brought in 5 country musicians who couldn't read a lick of music. But I sat down with my guitar, and I played it through a couple times. And within 15 minutes, they were in a nice little groove. It was sounding great. And we started off and recorded it. And then we had to convince Boyle to release it. Well, he wasn't ready to do that yet. Because of the monotony and repetition of the melody, he felt on the second 8, it needed a little color change of some kind. And that's when he got the idea to bring that amazing little girl in with that high-pitched voice that comes in on the second chorus of 26 Miles.
26 miles across the sea, Santa Catalina is waiting for me. Santa Catalina, the island of romance, 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 romance. 26 miles across the sea, Santa Catalina.
They had contests on radio stations all over the country. What is the high sound on the Four Preps record? And people thought it was a theremin or a flute or an organ. It was a little 16-year-old girl named Gwen Johnson who came in and ad-libbed that phrase. She sang it one time. We all looked at each other and said, "Okay, let's get that down on tape." And then what happened is, because technologically things were not nearly as advanced then, Gwen's voice became so loud on the second chorus that it drowned out our lead. So Voyle Gilmore said, "The only thing I can think to do is, could you guys be able to come in and sing your parts over the original?" We said, "Well, what he wants to sing? Different part?" "No, no, no. Sing the same parts you sang the first time. Just sing them again." And that's how the whole overdub thing happened, and nobody was doing it at the time. Les Paul and Mary Ford had overdubbed, but when Mary overdubbed her voice, each track she sang a different harmony.
That's right.
She didn't sing the same one over again. Well, we sang all the 4, including the solo, note for note for note over again, and suddenly we had this nice, echoey, surfy kind of sound. And from then on, of course, when it hit, we did every song that way, where we'd overdub ourselves.
Yes.
But that's how it all started, really, is to correct a mistake that we'd made.
And that gave you a much fuller, thicker, textured sound and feel.
No question of it. In fact, I'm flattered. We've been credited by people like Jimmy Buffett with starting what was called the California sound. I always call it a surfy kind of a sound. You could almost hear the surf in the background.
Sure.
And that's what created that sound. And from then on all our albums and every record we made from that point forward, we always put our voices on twice.
That is cool. That is cool. Now, before we leave 26 Miles, I do have to take issue with the fact that Catalina is at its closest 31 or more miles, quote, across the sea. Nobody really fact-checked this before.
Boy, I tell you, I'm waiting for you, man. I'm all set up to meet that argument. First of all, we got on the Today Show at one point. It was being done from Catalina, and Brian Gumbel was the host. And he said, "I looked out all the maps, And he said, I got to tell you, it's not 26 miles from anywhere that I'm flying. And I said, how do you know where I was when I wrote it was 26 miles away? He said, well, it's 23.9. That's usually what I get is it's 23.9 from the Long Beach terminal to Avalon. So for many years, I used to get kidded about it. It's not 26 miles. I've never heard anybody say 29 miles before, but I used to get kidded. It's really 23 miles. And then finally, after all those years of getting kidded about it, a guy came up to me. We did a show at the Balboa Bay Club in Orange County.
Sure.
And the guy came up after me. He says, I own a boat. I've got a doctor in Newport. I go to Catalina all the time. You might like to know it is precisely 26 miles from the Newport Beach landing to Avalon.
There
now
is.
I just tell people I wrote it at Newport.
Yes, yes. Well, it's better than floating 5 miles out somewhere. So.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, that's, I've been kidding about that forever, but I finally felt a little vindicated when he said, no, man, from Newport, it's exactly 26 miles.
You don't have to hear that one ever again. You got it. Okay.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Well, so despite this discrepancy, it did sell over 1 million copies. Was this really quick after release, or how long did that take?
Well, that's an interesting thing, David. It got released, which, as a young know-it-all who thought I had all the answers, I thought, well, these idiots are releasing a song about a tropical island in November, for crying out loud. I mean, who the hell's going to care about this kind of record and this kind of song? And it started to get some airplay after that guy in Hartford played it. And suddenly it was at the bottom of the charts, but it was starting to move up. Our producer at Capitol said, if we can make it through the Christmas crunch, with all the Christmas music, and the jocks are still playing it in January, we've got a chance for a hit. So we sweated out the Christmas season. We'd turn on the radio and hear Christmas carols. We wanted to hear our song. Luckily enough, jocks continued to play it. And interestingly enough, which I find really ironic and satisfying, is that over the years, I've had more people come up to me and say, I got to tell you, at that time, I was living in New Hampshire. And I'd be driving home through December and January with the snowdrifts on both sides and ice all over the roads, listening to you guys rhapsodize about this tropical island somewhere. And it was such a wonderful escape for me. I would turn the sound up and just get lost in the record. So actually, it kind of became a relief to the ice and snow back east for a lot of people. So all in all, we lucked out. We made it over the Christmas rush. January it started up, and by February, we were on the Ed Sullivan Show singing it.
Music from the Four Preps in conversation with Bruce Belland. The Four Preps are performing December 16th along with the Marcells, the Chantels, the Mystics, Lala Brooks of the Crystals, and the Skyliners. That's Legends of Doo-Wop and Rock and Roll at the California Theater in San Bernardino. AffordableMusicProductions.com for tickets. More with Bruce just ahead. Ozzy and Harriet, Gidget, and more. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR.
Ricky Nelson and the Four Preps.
Talk to me about the Four Preps connection to the Ozzy and Harriet show and Ricky Nelson.
Wow. Wow. Well, that would be right up there at the top of the list of fun experiences for me. We knew Rick at high school. I was in David Nelson's class at Hollywood High.
Oh, okay.
Rick's brother. And we were supposed to graduate in summer of 54. Well, that year I got elected head cheerleader, and I abused the privilege so much. I was never in class. I was always got something to do for the big game coming up, so I got set back a semester. So David graduated with the class of 54, as I was supposed to have done, and I stayed behind for an extra semester, and there along came Ricky Nelson, who I only knew having met him through David up at David's house after school. Well, suddenly he came along, and his brother said, you know, look for Bruce Belland. He knows where all the bodies are buried, so he'll help you out with negotiating your first couple of weeks at Hollywood High. So Rick looked me up, and we ended up taking typing class together, which we flunked. we were such screw-ups. I mean, he was a practical joker,
yeah.
And he could throw his voice. He was experimenting with ventriloquism. So, you know, the teacher up front of the class would say, may I have your attention? And this voice from the back go, no. Who said that? Who said it? So we had a lot of fun, but we flunked typing. But that's when I got to know Rick. And then the four preps performed on campus, and that made Rick further aware of us. And then he signs with Lou Chud at Imperial Records and is going to start recording. He wanted to do everything exactly the way Elvis had done it.
Sure.
So if Elvis got a certain kind of guitar, he'd get that kind of guitar. Well, Elvis had the Jordanaires back in him, so he wanted a four-man group back in him. And he called me and said, would you guys consider coming on a show? Are you kidding? Would we consider? We didn't even have our Screen Actors Guild cards. We weren't in the union yet. And traditionally, that was a long, months-long process with all kinds of forms to fill out and people to sponsor you. Well, Ozzy picked the phone up, and about 24 hours, we had our membership cards in the Screen Actors Guild.
Oh, good.
And went on the show to back him. And we backed Harriet on a couple of songs that she sang in some of the episodes. We became a singing fraternity brothers. So, you know, the scene would be in the game room of the fraternity house, and someone would start a song, and we'd come along and harmonized behind Rick. So we did that first season with Rick, and then we took off with him at the end of that first season on his first national tour. It's when he really broke through. And Life magazine created, a lot of people don't know this, created the term teen idol for Rick's picture on the front of Life magazine. It was the first time that expression was used. So we took off and did the tour with him. Here he is on the cover of Life magazine. Here we are on stage behind him. The first date we did was the Wisconsin State Fair. 35,000 screaming, crying, gasping girls.
Oh.
I mean, we couldn't even hear each other. I could see the other guy's lips moving, but I really couldn't hear much. It was just absolute bedlam. So we did that whole tour that summer. It was great. We did four or five state fairs with Ricky. The following year, one of the cast members on Ozzy and Harriet died in a boating accident, and they needed someone to fill his role. And they called me on the road with the preps and said, we'd like you to come on as a regular. So for the next 3 years, I alone was on the show with Ricky and played his roommate, his fraternity brother and stuff. So I learned so much from Ozzy that I would say there's probably 15 or 20% of my book is going to be talking about watching Harriet work, watching Ozzy write the show, direct the show, star in the show, film the show. It was an enormous experience for me when I later became a television producer and a network executive. I wrote Ozzy a note and said, boy, there's not a day that goes by that I don't use something I learned watching you all those years. Thank you so much for the education. I got a very sweet letter back from him thanking me for the thoughtful note. And it was just a great experience. They were my second family. In fact, Ozzy said in the note, he said, we always thought of all you young guys as part of our extended family. So glad to see you're doing well. Thanking me for my thanking him. A little redundant, but it was, you know, Harriet sends her love, and he said, NBC is so lucky to have your enthusiasm and talent. Congratulations. I mean, it was a high point in my life. He was an amazing man. He was one of the most amazing, creative, innovative people I've ever worked with. And I worked with everybody from Merv Griffin to Dick Clark to Ed Sullivan. But boy, Ozzy, people, I think, underestimate just how bright and how clever he was.
Music from The Four Preps in conversation with Bruce Belland. The Four Preps are performing December 16th along with the Marcells, the Chantels, the Mystics, Lala Brooks of the Crystals, and the Skyliners. That's Legends of Doo-Wop and Rock and Roll at the California Theater in San Bernardino. AffordableMusicProductions.com for tickets. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR.
She acts sort of teenage, just in between age, looks about 4'3". Although she's just small fry, just about so high, Gidget is the one for me.
Well, and now going beyond TV, now let's look at film for a second. You backed Ricky Nelson in TV, and you ended up backing Sandra Dee in the Gidget movie. Oh, my gosh.
Well, yeah, we didn't exactly back her. We did a song while she stood there and clapped her hands. Yeah, that was really kind of fun. I mean, we knew the real Gidget because I had dated quite a few girls from Uni High where she went to school. And we knew all about her and her getting in with the surf crowd at Malibu. And we were all knocked out when her father wrote the book Gidget and it came out, was the bestseller. And we were still chaffing at the bit to be in the movie. We had been on television and done tours with Ricky and stuff. But, you know, being kids from Hollywood High, we wanted to be in a movie.
Yeah.
And our manager called and said, hey, guess what? Columbia crossed. They want to put you in a picture.
Gidget is the one for me.
they're making a movie out of the novel Gidget. Well, we all knew the book, and we all said, oh, this is fabulous. Well, this is great. We're so excited. And then somebody said, well, who's playing Gidget? Then he said, Sandra D. Well, we had major crushes on Sandra D, all four of us.
Sure.
So that was icing on the cake. And that was a great experience. It was a wonderful director named Paul Wendkos. And we did the scene, the kind of payoff to the whole story is the big luau at the end of the summer on the beach and who's she going to get a date with and so forth. And so in the middle of this semi-orgy all over the sand with all these young couples, there we are standing like four eunuchs in a harem with our guitar. Where we're supposed to plug the electric guitars in on the beach, I have no idea. But welcome to movie magic, you know. And that was great fun. And Sandra D was absolutely adorable. I had a huge crush on her. I tried to get somewhere with her, but this guy named Bobby Darin kept getting in the way, so it didn't work out. But that was a fun experience.
If it weren't for those nobodies like Bobby Darin, yes. Oh, gosh. Wow.
Yeah.
You talking about being in this with Sandra D. I won't spend much time on this, but just the fact that Johnny Tillotson was so excited to get into a movie with Jane Mansfield, but she was not there the day that he was shooting, so he was chomping at the bit to go see Jane Mansfield. But the day that he got there, he ended up shooting with Phyllis Diller. Yeah.
Who, by the way, I have an autographed picture of her on the walls. We became very dear friends. I produced a lot of game shows for a while in which we'd use celebrities, and Phyllis was one of them. And the picture she sent me with a lovely inscription on it, she's quite beautiful. It's really funny.
Yep.
I mean, she made herself look silly and gawky and everything, but she was really quite a lovely woman, a very well-trained classical pianist, which a lot of people didn't know.
Oh, I never
knew. At the end of her career, she did symphony orchestra concerts all over the country playing piano. But she was... Phyllis Diller. Well, and on Ozzy and Harriet, he really broke type at one point and booked Mamie Van Doren on the show. And the episode, it was really kind of racy for Ozzy and Harriet, sponsored by the American Milk Council, you know, was called The Exotic House Mother. And the whole deal was that Mamie Van Doren's a stripper called, I'm not kidding with this name, Bubbles Latassel. And Bubbles Latassel, as a publicity stunt, had herself named as honorary house mother to our fraternity. So she came over with a photographer to take pictures of, you know, tying our tie for us and making us cookies in the kitchen and all the house mother things. And the whole twist in the plot was then we all say goodbye to her thinking that's it, we've shot the picture, she's leaving. She comes back an hour later with a suitcase and a photographer to spend the night. So, oh my God, what if the dean finds out? What are we going to do? So she spends the night, and at one point there's a montage that Ozzy does. She's got high heels on, a skirt that is so tight she can barely walk in it, and one of these Madonna-type pointed bras under
right.
her sweater.
Right.
And she's strutting around a fraternity house. And at one point, there's a scene where she goes up and there's a sick guy in bed in his pajamas with a thermometer in his mouth. And she wiggles over and pulls the thermometer out and looks at it and puts it back in, pats him on the cheek and flirts with him a little bit and then wiggles out of the room. Well, the gag is that Ricky comes over to the guy in bed after she leaves, pulls the thermometer out and says, 105. Cut the scene. I was the guy in the bed. So, you know, she comes over, she pulls the thermometer, she looks at it, she puts it back in my mouth, she wiggles out of the room. Rick comes over and says, 105. And in my best Jerry Lewis voice, I went, it was worth it, which was an ad-lib. And you never ad-libbed on the show. Ozzy wouldn't stand for it, but he loved that line so much he left it in. It was my one and only ad-lib. I never tried it again because he kind of, you know, looked at me like, don't do that again, but we'll let this one stay in the show.
Really loved it. Now don't do it again. Okay, beautiful.
Yeah, right.
Sweet. Okay, while we're laughing, you know, I have to say that before we go further, I really grew up on the music of the 50s and early 60s, early and mid-60s, let's say, because of my mom's records. My dad is class of 56, mom was class of 59, and so this is
perfect,
really,
yeah.
Before I discovered Ozzy Osbourne, I yeah.
Boy, there's contrast for you.
Yeah, you got that right. The Ozzys.
We have the Fleetwoods, a very successful group. Let's send them to Alaska to entertain our troops.
When they start in a singing and putting on their show, the temperature around them will be 45 below. Mr. Blue, when I say I'm freezing, just turn around.
You know, 26 Miles and all the pretty songs and all the beautiful stuff that got you to the sock hop or whatever. But now I'd love to hear about More Money for You and Me. Was that another Belland and Larson combination?
It was when we wrote together. I'll tell you how that happened. I
Please.
Grew up in West Hollywood. My old man was a preacher, West Hollywood Community Church, literally two blocks off the Sunset Strip. And I was so besotted and fascinated by show business that when my parents would fall asleep on Saturday night, the night before our big Sunday church events, I would sneak out of the back door of the house and go up to the Sunset Boulevard and walk up and down Sunset, and wherever I could befriend myself to the doorman, I'd sneak in the back of places like Ciro's, Macambo's, the Moulin Rouge, the nightclubs, and watch the acts that were there. And I was a little white-haired, I mean, I was almost looked like I was an albino. I had buttermilk-colored hair, and I was about 4.5 feet tall, and I had a really good gift of gab. I'd watched my dad operate with the congregation, so I knew all the stuff to charm people with. So I would make friends with these different doormen, and they would let me in the back door of the nightclubs and sometimes get a folding chair for me and let me sit there and watch the Mills Brothers or whomever.
Oh, wow.
And one night, I got into Ciro's and sat backstage watching Sammy Davis Jr. He did a song, I think it was Because of You, there's a song in my heart. He started the song as Tony Bennett. He did four bars as Tony Bennett. Then he did four bars as Tony Martin. Then he did four bars as whoever. So all the way through the song, from line to line to line, he would change his impression to another singer. And I thought, isn't that an interesting thing to do? In those days, most impressionists would say, and now a singer who sounds a little bit like this. And then they do a little bit of that. And here's another fella that you might recognize. And they do another one. I thought, what a great idea to weave it all together in one song with kind of a storyline. Then along comes Kennedy, and along comes the Peace Corps, and suddenly we get the idea, why not do a song that says, send all the other competitive groups away in the Peace Corps all around the world, which will mean more money for you and me. And we sat down and wrote it and did it in an in-person album. We made four or five albums with Capitol before we got a hit album. All of them were studio albums until our producer said, you know, the thing that got you your recording contract was the live show tape that you gave us to listen to, and because you're the audience laughing at your impressions and your parodies, why don't we do a live album and do one of those numbers in that album and see what happens? So we went to USC with a 22-piece band, made an album called The Four Preps on Campus, and in it was More Money for You and Me as part of our live stage act. Well, it wasn't more than a week when the album came out until all the jocks were pulling it out of the album and playing it as a single. The problem was that version was 4 minutes and 12 seconds long, so they went back and re-edited it to about 3:40, I think, was the final length. They took out a couple of imitations and released it, and it totally catapulted our career to a new level because it's great for your career to get a hit album. It's even better for your bookings if you get a hit album that's a live performance, because the people listen to it, listen to the enthusiasm, listen to the laughter. And there's several places in More Money where they're laughing, and what we're saying as a line is not that funny. They're laughing at a piece of physical business we're doing up on stage, you know. And I remember saying to Val Kilmer when he released it as a single, he said, that's going to really help your bookings. I said, well, yeah, but there's a lot of places in the album where people are screaming and laughing, and they have no idea. He said, don't you understand? That's why they'll buy a ticket when you come to town, so they can go and see what the heck people were laughing at. So it turned out to be a great break for us, and year after it came out, we did 142 colleges in that year. So it really turned our career into a whole other thing.
Why must I be a teenager in jail?
Where these groups all come from, we really do not know. But if they ever ask us, we will tell them where to go. Singing group from England far away. She lost her mind, she lost her heart when they began to play. I wanna hold your hand. So my girl wrote a letter to the Beatles saying you're so fine.
say that ain't enough. You gotta send us 25 cents for an autographed picture, $1 bill for a fan club card. And if you send in right away, you get a lock of hair from our St. Bernard. Oh, no, no. I wanna hold your hand. So she wrote another letter to the Beatles.
Another fun one. Letter to the Beatles. Let's talk about this one, please. This is another one that caught my attention.
You're listening to the end of the Four Preps recording career.
Well, is Letter to the Beatles by chance a reaction to the British invasion?
Yeah, absolutely. And Beatlemania, primarily Beatlemania. We just thought it was funny as heck. Glenn and I formed a record label called Larbel Music, and we had a folk singer-songwriter under contract to us who wrote a song called A Letter to Haley. It was when Haley Mills was red hot, and this was about a guy who had a crush on her and wrote her a letter and got an answer that said, send 25 cents for a fan club card, yada, yada.
Right.
We released his record of it. It didn't do anything at all. Didn't get any traction. And at one point, Glenn said, you know, why don't we rewrite it about the Beatles, A Letter to the Beatles, and some guy's girlfriend is crazy about them, and he's having a heck of a time with it. So we wrote it, recorded it, put it out, sucker was screaming up the charts with a bullet, and we get a call in Oklahoma City where we're performing from our producer, Capitol, who says, guys, I got some bad news for you. What? Capitol's pulling your record. What?
Hmm?
Yeah, Capitol's pulling your record out of the store. For why? He said, well, a man named Brian Epstein called the Capitol Towers yesterday and said, we have heard the Four Preps new release, and we are not amused. Capitol panicked and pulled it from all the stores. And, David, I got the most amazing and ironic letter from a woman just a few years ago saying at the time this all happened, she was working in the Capitol Records pressing plant in Sydney, Australia, and she came back from lunch one day with her fellow secretaries and was told to report downstairs to the warehouse for the afternoon. They went downstairs in their high heels and skirts and were handed, as they walked into the warehouse downstairs, sledgehammers. And all across the floor of the warehouse were 2,045 singles, A Letter to the Beatles. And they were ordered to spend the afternoon with these sledgehammers, smashing them all to smithereens so no one could buy one.
They were smash hits.
Every hit the hammer on the head. Well, you know, the reason she wrote me is all these years she had snuck one out under her skirt at the end of the day.
Good for her. Good.
And she had an intact copy of it, and would I like to have it? She always felt so terrible because she said, all of us secretaries, we just loved the Four Preps. We were all kind of sniffling and crying as we're smashing your records to bits. So, I mean, that's how that nobody, well, now it's all over YouTube, of course. It's had, you know, millions of hits, and,
yep,
and everybody, it's on our compilation albums, the Capitol now releases, so I wouldn't imagine that the Beatles ever even heard it, because I think they were pretty funny guys and they might have taken it with a grain of salt, but their management was convinced it was going to be very bad for their image and they had to pull the record. That sort of signaled for us. We kind of looked at each other and said, you know something, guys, let's get reality here. With the Motown invasion and the British invasion and stuff, maybe we start thinking about a day job.
And their day jobs turned out to be incredibly interesting as well. But that will have to come at a later date. I spoke with Bruce Belland of the Four Preps about so much more, and we will be including this on a show again at a later date. Bruce Belland of the Four Preps joining the Marcells, the Chantels, the Mystics, Lala Brooks of the Crystals, and the Skyliners for Legends of Doo-Wop and Rock and Roll at the California Theater in San Bernardino, December 16th, affordablemusicproductions.com for more.
That's just about going to wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to Bruce Belland, a wonderful conversation there, and to Nathan Gothels of Affordable Music Productions. Thanks also to comedian Graham Elwood. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Jessica Greenwell, Sasha Chavez, and Mike Pesavento. Beyond the music of the Four Preps, music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts are composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. You can hear past KVC Arts programs via podcast at kvcrnews.org/arts. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support.